each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, a little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him. And without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved, and the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal, hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song.
Jimmy Durante on a Saturday morning. I'm David Rothenberg. It's a little bit after 8. It's the last Saturday in August. The summer's over. Oh, I know, it's not till the 21st of September, but the summer's over. Have your pencils and paper out today, kids, because against my instincts, we'll be doing theater tickets for you. We did this for 3 decades here on WBAI, raising money for the station and getting you to the theater. And for a multitude of reasons, it has been halted. But I've been getting calls from producers and general managers of Broadway and off-Broadway shows saying, we want the BAI listeners, please. And the BAI listeners respond. So have your pencil and paper out. And we have tickets for a few shows today so you can support BAI. It's almost incumbent on people behind a mic to command your attention, to say dramatic things like breaking news. So I'll say the word sex, and then that will hold you, because there are 2 stories with sexual connotation that are in the news this week. And all you have to do is say sex and ears perk up. And it's a bottomless pit of interest, isn't it? I'm fascinated by the fascination that people have about other people's sexual acts or behavior or inclinations. It baffles me. Not the fascination that people have, but I'm more fascinated by the bottomless pit of interest that people have about other people's sex, because I'm not particularly interested in what other people do within the privacy of the boudoir. But Amnesty International has, the council endorsed a new policy calling for the decriminalization of global sex trade. And there's an op-ed piece in the Times today from Dublin by a woman who was in the sex trade, arguing very much against it from her personal experience. I read with great interest her perspective. I don't totally agree, but I understand her, why she has reached her position. I, at the Fortune Society over the years, have worked with and befriended more than a few women who were former prostitutes and who shared with candor their personal experiences and their perspective. And the one thing I came out of all of that is that prostitution should not be, women who are engaged in prostitution should not be encaged, because in almost every case, every individual, every woman that I met who was involved in prostitution, they ended up learning about other crimes while they were in Rikers or wherever they would go for their 30 or 60 days. And most had no other options vocationally at that point in their lives. So that's the one sex story. The other is that there was a raid on a business called Rent-A-Boy, a $10 million mail internet service housed in Greenwich Village in offices, and they've been there for years. It's the first I heard of them. I was impressed by the rates that some men were getting for a weekend. But my reaction to that, to the story was, and I had made a note as soon as I heard about it, and there's a Times editorial today, Homeland Security, representing the government, did the raid. Aren't they supposed to be going after the alleged terrorists that are endangering our very existence? Why is Homeland Security spending its resources, its men, its people power and its energy going after a sex trade business? My other reaction to that is that, to that story, is that after the raid, if they got all the papers, there'll be a lot of nervous married men in New York City. Here's Chet Baker.
Writing songs of love, but not for me. A lucky stars above, but not for me. With love to lead the way, I've found more clouds of gray than any Russian play could guarantee. I was a fool to fall and get that way. I hoe, alas, and also lack-a-day. Although I can't dismiss the memory of her kiss, I guess she's not for me. Thank you. a fool to fall and get that way. Hi-ho, alas, and also lack-a-day. Although I can't dismiss the memory of her kiss, I guess she's not for me.
Chet Baker, if you're not familiar with his life, somebody should do a film biography. This young man with that sensitive, romantic voice who looked like Elizabeth Taylor's twin brother when he was a young man. He was not handsome, he was pretty. Whose journey into drugs and the pictures of what he looked like near the end before he jumped out of or fell out of a window in Amsterdam. His face looked like an aerial view of the Rocky Mountains. He was so dissipated looking. We all age and we're not quite don't have the same look we had when we were young, but there's sometimes a hint of recognition. Not with Chet Baker, but he's left us his trumpet and his voice. I told you to get the pencil and paper out because we have theater tickets for you. When we offered Amazing Grace a few weeks ago during the mini-thon, the people who've seen it called thanking me profusely as if I wrote it. And I assured them that I merely was the catalyst getting them to see this Broadway musical. Amazing Grace is the musical love story based on the life and trials of John Newton. Now, I had known of Newton as the author of the song Amazing Grace, which concludes this Broadway musical at the Nederlander Theater in an incredible choral presentation that just rocks the theater. What I did not know about him is that he came to his sense of religious commitment in writing that song as an 18th century English slave trader inheriting his father's business, and that between the woman he met and who he loved, who was an abolitionist, and witnessing some of the cruelty imposed on the slaves in the slave trade, the story how Newton evolved into an abolitionist was more than I anticipated when I saw Amazing Grace. And of course, that rendition of Amazing Grace, it's an original musical with powerful solo numbers and group numbers and song and dance as a Broadway musical commands. We have tickets this week for Amazing Grace. If you, $100 to BAI and you get a pair of tickets, probably one of the best deals in town you can get to the theater. We have tickets for Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Tuesday and Thursday are at 7 o'clock. Wednesday's at 8. Friday night at 8. And Saturday night of Labor Day weekend at 8. And I know that you might read in the New York Times or hear on the television news that everybody's out of town on the weekend. And as I've pointed out in the past, go to Times Square on 4th of July or Labor Day weekend and you will see so many people. You will think that there's been an invasion from other planets. I know there's at least 6 people listening to BAI who will be in town this weekend. So if you want to see Amazing Grace, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday and Saturday, when we have tickets, and a limited number, I may add, the two numbers you can call are 347-942-2037. I've been told to say it slowly and frequently. Get the pencil, get the paper. 347-942-2037 or 917-600-3469. That's 917-600-3469. And if you were even thinking of it, I would call now because the last time we offered this, Amazing Grace, $100 for 2 tickets on Broadway at the Nederlander Theater, near the end of the program, people kept calling and they were gone. So because we have a limited number for the week, Tuesday through Saturday nights. So the numbers again are 347-942-2037 and 917-600-3469. Later in the program, I'm anticipating a guest in studio, Khalil Cumberbatch. The longtime listeners might recall last year the ordeal, the odyssey of Khalil, the young man who, on the week that he was getting his master's degree at Lehman College, at home with his wife and two little girls, immigration came and cuffed him at home, and he was locked up for 6 months, and many of us fought for his freedom, which was achieved. He was facing deportation to a country he left when he was two, where he knew no one because everyone that he knew had come here with him, his family, and who knew the whereabouts 35 years later of the people that he left. So Khalil will be joining us a little later. Call for tickets for Amazing Grace while Etta James serenades us.
A cigarette that bears lipstick traces, an airline ticket to romantic places, and still my heart has wings. These foolish things remind me of you. Tinkling piano in the next apartment, those stumbling words that told you what my heart meant, a fairground painted swings. These foolish things remind me of you. You came, oh, you saw, you conquered me. When you did that to me, I knew somehow, oh, this had to be. Telephone that rings, but who's to answer? And oh, how the ghost of you clings. These foolish things remind me of you. You came and you saw. You conquered me. But when you did that to me, yeah, I knew somehow, oh, this had to be. The winds of March and make my heart a dancer. Remind me of you. Oh yeah, these foolish things, these crazy things, these foolish things, these crazy things, all of these things, all remind me of you.
Etta James. I came late to Etta James. It wasn't until about 3 or 4 years ago when I knew of her. I guess I must have heard her, but I wasn't aware of it. although I don't know how I could have heard her and not been aware of it. But when I heard her sing At Last, way before Beyonce recreated it in the movie, and I thought, ooh, there's some pain in that larynx. There's some soul that's coming out there that's rather evident. Etta James. I clip little tidbits from the papers that items that sometimes appear in the briefing section of the New York Times that don't get national play. They're not on the breaking news on CNN, certainly not Fox News, but things that I want to share with you because they're of importance and they deserve some awareness. This one is, these are both from the Times, and that little, they have a section called National Briefings, which I read every day religiously. Well, not religiously, that's the word I shouldn't use. I read with interest because these are items that are often very revealing about what's happening in the country. The vast majority of kindergarten-age children in the United States are vaccinated against preventable diseases, but sizable pockets of unprotected children posed a public health threat, according to a government study released. Only 1.7% of parents of kindergartners sought exemptions in 2014 from laws requiring vaccination of children, according to the study by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Rates vary nationwide, however, with at least one state, Idaho, not surprising, reporting more than 6% of parents seeking exemptions. Lawmakers in at least 10 states are trying to tighten school vaccination exemption rules after a measles outbreak at Disneyland sickened more than 100 people this year. There's that blonde woman who's on television. I can't remember her name. She had a child born autistic, and she said it was diagnosed six months after vaccination. And she attributes it to that, and she has no scientific information. And I heard a report saying that the age when the autism was recognized in the child is when it is recognized, and that the vaccination has nothing to do with it. But she's been on a strong campaign. And what that does when a child is not vaccinated and becomes infected, it endangers the other children. Particularly, there are some children who cannot get vaccinated because they have birth defects that they're on some other medication that prevents them from getting the vaccinations, and their lives are endangered by children who are not vaccinated who become infected. It's an important health issue, and there's a group of hysterics, particularly in California, who are insisting that, it was incredible, one woman said, there hasn't been a polio case in our county in 15 years. Why should my child have to get vaccinated against it? The reason there hasn't been a polio case in your county in 15 years is because children were getting the polio vaccine. Science is not always wrong. I grew up at a time where the pools closed in the summer in our town because of the polio epidemic, and every school had a kid who suddenly was paralyzed because of polio. And then came the Salk and Sabin vaccines, and it stopped. You have to, it's part of that whole, the anti-science aspect, which affects our approach to climate control. The other story that I saw in the Times that captured my attention, Governor Doug Ducey in Arizona said on Wednesday that the state had canceled its contract with a private prison operator over a series of security and training lapses that set the stage for riots at a prison in July. He also ordered the Department of Correction to assess operations of all private prisons in the state. Mr. Ducey, a Republican, described the riots at a minimum security prison operated by the Management and Training Corporation in Kingman as frightening, disturbing, and completely unacceptable. The riots, which began on July 1st, forced the transfer of 1,100 prisoners from several housing units that were destroyed. 9 correction officers suffered minor injuries. The privatizing of the prisons is one of the big ripoffs being. And when I read about a lot of conservatives now calling for some revising of prison policy. I'm always afraid that they're in cahoots with the privatized prison industry, which cuts costs and makes profits at the expense of the nutrition and the opportunities and the programs that might be afforded inmates. And I visited that privatized halfway house that Christie has in New Jersey, which I described as Rikers Island Light. There was a series of exposures about it when guys were walking out and not coming back. They were called escapees to frighten the public. What they were is they could go out every day working, but there's not. When you go into it, it's 600 or 700 men in a building that's hardly a halfway house. I wonder whatever happened to that after the Times and the Newark Star Ledger wrote those exposés of the Christie's privatized facilities. I wonder what happened. The phones are ringing like crazy in there. You know, the two numbers I gave you are both cell phones, so it takes time for them to get all the calls. I'll tell you about the second show for which we have tickets. And I finally saw Africa, My Beautiful. It is a stunning show. It is, I said to producer Eric Krebs afterwards, I don't know what you do with this. It's so beautiful and it's so poignant and so special. It's not for the tourists. It's not for a big Broadway theater. It's two women, an older woman, Thuli Dumakudi, who grew up under apartheid in South Africa, and Tandraza Tawangwa, who grew up in Zimbabwe in the post-colonial African born free generation, telling the stories of their African childhoods from the perspective of under apartheid for one and not under apartheid, but not having the legacy of it. And they tell stories, but of course, the highlight of the evening is the beautiful voices that they have, Thuli, the songs that they sing. Thuli was in The Lion King for many years and in the film Cry Freedom, but many of you saw her last year when she led six women in that stunning off-Broadway musical called I Sing for Freedom. And the young woman, Tanya Adzwa, is a recent Princeton graduate, a beautiful young woman, and a really gifted singer and musician, all of which is in evidence in Africa, My Beautiful. You have an opportunity to see it only through BAI this week and next week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. A $50 gift to BAI gets you two tickets. And I'll give you the numbers to see Africa, My Beautiful. I had a wonderful time. I took four of the young people from Fortune, and my friend Sherry and I had dinner with the young ones first. And this for two of them, this was of the four, it was their first time going to the theater. And I'll give you the best review possible. The next day, one of them came up to me who had never seen a show before and said, "David, what are we going to see this week?" He's now wants to go to the theater, having seen Africa, My Beautiful. The numbers you call for tickets to that are 347-942-2037. That's Daryl. These are cell phones that you're calling, and they're here taking the calls at BAI. 347-942-2037 or 917-600-3469. That's 917-600-3469. 3469 for Africa, My Beautiful. Cab Calloway's in the house.
Yeah. This one like one of good old revival days. A camp meeting. Yowza, yowza. There's a dear brother got happy on that clarinet. Look at it. Great day. about it, brother. Tell me all about it now. That's it, son. Get ready for this scat sermon I'm going to give you here. Look out now. Give him the give him the bob up and the kind of camp meetings we have in Harlem. Yeah, man. Beat it out, Brother Payne. Beat it out there, son. Swing them gas. Yeah, man. Easy now, easy now. Look out, brother. Tell me all about it, brother. Is you ready? Is you ready? So help me, you is. Yeah, man.
Cab Calloway here on a... turn down the echo chamber. Cab Calloway on Saturday morning. I had announced earlier that Khalil Cumberbatch will be with us, and he is, and he's going to be talking with us in a few minutes. Some political observations this week. Well, I'm reading the New York... I haven't finished it yet. It's longer than... It's longer than War and Peace, that the New Yorker essay on Donald Trump. Fascinating. What Trump has done is he's moved all the other candidates to the right, to trying to, well, they're trying to do make explosive or incendiary comments to draw attention because he's dominating the media. And Jeb Bush suddenly came out fighting, and that's sort of like Jeb Bush fighting has prompted me to revise my assessment. I thought he was clearly going the front runner and the candidate. He is monumentally dull and not particularly inspiring, and my sister who lives in Florida said, you have no idea how awful he is, what a bad governor he was. Well, I'm getting a hint, but I've also realized that the public might think a third Bush is one too many. George W. didn't leave a great taste in the mouth of many people. But what Trump has done is he's taken the immigration issue and he's diluted he's done? He has utilized the classic Machiavellian political trait of scapegoating a particular group of people. And there was a quote in the New Yorker article, a woman in New Hampshire said, the immigrants are all over, and the reporter said, in New Hampshire, and she said, they're everywhere, they're sucking us dry. It's a way of not dealing with the 1%, which is draining the economy because a disproportionate, you may have heard that overwhelmingly, 1% of the population has 25% of the revenue, and that issue is being ignored in all of these dialogues that the Republicans are having. But Trump has, we've thought it would be a 2-week splurge, but it's really having an impact, and I think hurting the Republican Party. Now, on the Democratic side, the emergence of Joe Biden, I've decided, is that the what's the word I want to use, to the mainstream of the Democratic leadership, the people that are making the decisions have suddenly decided that Hillary might be vulnerable. The email story has lasted longer than they thought, and Joe Biden is in the wings to make sure that they have a viable, winnable candidate. And Joe Biden is a rather appealing candidate with not the baggage that many other political stars have. So I think that they have Biden in the wings if Hillary's email baggage weighs her down as it goes along. The thing about Hillary is there are very few people who really like her. They will support her. She's certainly better than everybody else that the Republicans are offering. But and those of us who love the idea of a woman running for president were very attracted to the notion of Elizabeth Warren, and don't have the same feeling about Hillary that we have about Warren. I don't see that kind of intensity for Hillary that I see for people who are attracted to the possibility of a Liz Warren candidate. President, which is not going to happen this time. She's made it clear. But it's Trump has controlled the media, and he's staying in it because he likes the attention. And God bless America. Huh? I'm going to play, I guess it's time for Out on a Limb, isn't it? Should I play one song and then we'll do that? We'll have Christine Andreas and then we'll do Out on a Limb. Where are you, Christine? I'm looking for you. Here's a song by Rodgers and Hammerstein from The King and I.
We've just been introduced. I do not know you well. But when the music started, something drew me to your side. So many men and girls are in each other's arms. It made me think we might be similarly occupied. Shall we then say goodnight and mean goodbye? Oh, perchance, when the last little star has left the sky, shall we still be together with our arms around each other? And shall you be my new romance? On the clear understanding that this kind of thing can happen, shall we dance? Shall we dance? When the last little star has left the sky, shall we still be together with our arms around each other? And shall you be mine? Romance on the clear understanding that this kind of thing can happen. Shall we dance? Shall we dance?
Christine Andreas from Rodgers and Hammerstein's King and I. She would have been a very good Anna, actually. I'm told from Ticket Central that The Amazing Grace, the Broadway musical for which we offered tickets at the top of the program, almost gone. We had tickets for all this week, $100 gift to BAI, and you get a pair of tickets. Tuesday, Thursday, and Wednesday and Saturday are gone. Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, I think there's a pair left for each on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. So if you were trying to get through and you couldn't, now is the time to call. They are on their cell phone, so they can only take one call at a time. It's not like when we had a phone bank. Remember when we were grown-ups and we had real phone service here? So you can call 347-942-2037 or 917 800-600-3469 for tickets. $100 to BAI, two tickets to see Amazing Grace on Broadway at the Nederlander Theater. Just about three or four pair left for Tuesday, Thursday, and Tuesday. You'll call them. They'll tell you. I'm not there with them. They're down the hall. The musical about John Newton, the man who wrote Amazing Grace, and the story is that he, which I never knew, that he was a former slave trader in 18th century England, and discovered through the slave trade and from the woman he loved, who was an abolitionist, a woman named Mary Catlett, who should be part of history, evolved into a man of social conscience and wrote the song Amazing Grace, which is, if you're walking past the Nederlander Theater some night at about 10:30, you will hear the most gorgeous rendition ever in the history of Amazing Grace. So call 347-942-2037 or 917-600-3469. Don't wait, because there are only three or four pair left when I went in there. All right, Out on a Limb, our weekly editorial. In the past, I've made it abundantly clear how I view various religions in the world, their political postures and dogmas that shape much of how we live, not the faith of individuals who rely on that enigmatic being that roams the galaxy, to whom they offer their prayers, praying that the Omnipotent One will cure their illness, assure them that their football team will win this Saturday, or bring their loved ones back from the latest armed conflict. I recognize the importance for many to cling to some unseen, mysterious persona, one who provides a blueprint for all that is just and good. Church-going provides moral sustenance and an opportunity to recognize the individual's role in the universe, determining moral and ethical choices. Religion serves society best as a traffic light, hopefully minimizing the amount of damage we inflict on one another. Religious practitioners, on the other hand, is a more complex story. I first had a hint of this as a college freshman with a roommate who was a fractured Catholic. I had never heard anyone rail with such emotion. All the time I was in high school, I never heard anyone be so anti-religious. He was just emoting against the church, and he should have shared only part of his rage with me, and it was the first I would ever hear of sexual abuse by a priest. He never finished his freshman year because he was a severely wounded, very bright young man, and I always hoped he found therapy to help him erase his demons. But religious hypocrisy has always been part of the terrain. The Inquisitions, slavery justified as part of economic necessity. Recent stories reveal that the Episcopal Church owned ships importing slaves from Africa. The extermination of Jews with church complicity, a condition which lingers today. Anti-Semitism, like racism, is steeped in religious voodoo. Two headline stories have emerged this year, vastly different, but with similar roots. ISIS males, it's been reported, explain sexual abuse of women as part of their religion, though Muslim scholar rejected thoroughly. But the role of male entitlement is also ingrained in Christian and Jewish orthodoxy. Rape in the armed forces and on the college campus has always been and continues to be part of contemporary culture, drawing attention because they can be framed in institutional settings. But much of male sexual entitlement manifests itself away from the media spotlight, and much of this is deeply ingrained in religious teaching. Not the sexual part, but the sense of male entitlement. As self-appointed moralists advocate against abortion clinics, they are painfully silent about the sexual acts that drive many women to the clinics. I cannot speak for women, nor do I presume to, but I can listen to stories of subjugation that has a direct impact how the greater society determines political and economic gender equality. Around the globe, religion is the main barrier. Then there is the absurdity now of a man in court these days in Ohio whose religious belief, he claims, is compromised if he has to bake a cake for a gay couple. I don't know where culinary guidance is in the Bible, but it's been a clarion call in the corridors of political power, with some candidates for president arguing that religious beliefs be protected and that the cake should not be baked. I recall when I was a member of the New York City Human Rights Commission, 3 decades back, a burning issue was a move to add sexual orientation to the list which protected citizens against discrimination in employment, housing, and public accommodations, a list that includes race, religion, gender, country of origin. And I suggested that the 12-member Human Rights Commission unanimously support this fundamental right of people to be protected. An Orthodox rabbi, member of the Human Rights Commission, a political appointee, as we all were, which placates communities which vote in large numbers. And the rabbi said, I can't vote for that. I don't approve of the gay lifestyle. And I said to him, Rabbi, I'm not wild about your lifestyle, the Orthodox Jewish lifestyle, but I would fight to the bitter end to protect you from discrimination. I also pointed out to him that many people were suspect and offended by people who were different, with Orthodox garb, messy beards, hats, large hats. The language being different is very threatening to a lot of people, but the Bill of Rights is there to protect all of us, not those of us who represent the majority who look acceptable. The rabbi agreed to abstain so we could convey the impression of unanimity. More than anything else, it's been the silences of the great religions. Of course, some of our great leaders of inclusion have been up from the cloth, Martin Luther King and Gandhi, extraordinary human beings. And there are churches today that provide food for the poor and the hungry, reaching out. But for every Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi or a Riverside church, there are pockets of great silences, church leaders invoking fear and threats if the dogma is not observed. Visit our prisons and our schools, and you will recognize the moral vacuum in America, and the silences are deafening. Church on Sunday, it's part of Americana. What happens on Monday? That's what should reflect the piety of the Sabbath. I'm David Rothenberg, out on a limb.
That you're bored, anything, but don't assume I know. Tell me what you feel.
What I feel? You know exactly how I feel. Why do you insist you must hear the words when you know I cannot give you words? Not the ones you There's nothing to say. I cannot be what you want.
What do you want,
I needed
George?
You and you left.
There was no room
you
for me.
You will not accept who I am. I am what I do, which you knew, which you always knew, which I thought you were a part of.
No, you are complete, George. You are your own. We do not belong. Should have.
one of the saddest love songs that I've ever written. Could you hear it? It was Bernadette Peters singing We Do Not Belong Together to Mandy Patinkin and Stephen Sondheim, Sunday in the Park with George. Most love songs are about he beats me, but I love him anyway. This is a woman saying, we just don't belong together. I loved you once, but we don't make it. And that's a very Sondheim-ish kind of love song. There are no tickets left for Amazing Grace, all gone. Thank you, listeners. We do have tickets remaining for Africa, My Beautiful, the two gorgeous women. They are, I can't tell you how thrilling it was to watch them in Africa, My Beautiful at the very intimate Playroom Theater on West 46th Street. And we have tickets for that Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday this week and next. Tule Dumakudi telling the stories of what it was like under apartheid Africa in South Africa. And then the voice is she says that in the show, she sings a Makeba song saying that Makeba was her inspiration. Tule, I loved Makeba, but your voice is better. And Tanya Dadzwa is from Zimbabwe and is a young woman, recent Princeton graduate, and a post-colonial African woman telling stories mostly of what she was told by her parents and grandparents, but who grew up in a freer country than did Tule. And her voice, she is, well, if I could pronounce her name correctly, I would do it, because she will be heard from this. She just graduated from Princeton last year, and her persona is so stunning that I can't imagine that with her talent and her looks that she won't be heard from in the musical theater here in this country. So if you want tickets to Africa, My Beautiful, we have tickets for it Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday this week and next. Performances are at 7 o'clock. The Playroom Theater is on 46th Street, and you call 347-942-2037. That's 347-942-2037 or 917-600-3469. 917-600-3469. So we'll do the Arts Corner, and then we'll be talking with Khalil Cumberbatch. All right, book theater, that's it. No movies this week. Too busy. Believe it or not, I didn't see a movie all week. I'm always thankful when a new Ann Perry novel is released, and I'm equally grateful that she's prolific with her 19th century protagonist, a London River cop, William Monk, and then there's the husband and wife detective team, Charlotte and Thomas Perry. The newest offering, a book called Corridors of the Night, published by Ballantine, is a William Monk tale, though it's his wife, Hester, front and center. It's a nail biter, and the author, Perry, is so meticulous that you can almost feel the London fog along the Thames as you're reading the book. Hester, Monk's wife, is a nurse from the Flo Nightingale School of Heroics and Tender Loving Care. She's caught in a conundrum. She's assisting a scientist on the verge of a life-saving blood transfusion cures. This is 19th century, you know. And then she discovers that little children are being used as guinea pigs, and then it gets worse before it gets better. And I've read about 20 Ann Perry thrillers, only to learn now that there are about 30 more for me to discover. So if you haven't read your first Ann Perry novel, treat yourself. You could start with this one, Corridors of the Night, and work yourself back. Ann Perry, Corridors of the Night. At the theater, Annie Baker's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, The Flick, is receiving a second life in a compelling production at the Barrow Street Theater down in the Village. It's in the Greenwich House, for those of you who know the Village. The Flick, the Flick itself is an outdated movie house, and it's the workplace where a trio of lonely social outcasts have gathered. And we become accustomed to witnessing the vocational crisis of the privileged and the powerful. And it's fascinating to observe Sam, Avery, and Rose, the three people in the Flick, with their fears, their conflicts, and their frustrations in a humdrum existence that mirrors the angst of presidents and CEOs. The work games, the banterings, the petty slights, the imagined betrayals, they're all in evidence here. Miss Baker and her director, Sam Gold, are obsessively patient with their characters. There are more pauses in the flick than in a season of Pinter plays. It unfolds slowly. We gain insights of the trio. Matthew Mayer, Aaron Clifton Moten, and Louisa Krauss are uniformly excellent as the three characters in the play that stays for you long after the final curtain. It's a won the Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago in a limited engagement. It's been brought back with its original cast. It's called The Flick. It's on Barrow Street. And guess what? We have tickets for the BAI listeners this week, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday night. Wednesday and Thursday at 7:30, Friday at 8, and next Sunday, Labor Day weekend, both the matinee and the evening. If you want to see The Flick, Pulitzer Prize-winning play by Annie Baker. She's having a big year. Her new play has just opened with Georgia Engel in it at the Playwrights, I think. Got great reviews. This one is her first, The Flick, at the Barrow Street, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night, and Sunday night, and Sunday matinee also. Call 347-942-2037, Daryl at 347-942-2037, or easy at 917-600-3469. And you can get tickets for The Flick. Here's Chet Baker.
I get along without you very well. Of course I do. Except when soft rains fall and drip from leaves, then I recall the thrill of being sheltered in your arms. Of course I do. But I get along without you very well. I've forgotten you just like I should. Of course I have. Except to hear your name or someone's laugh that is the same. But I've forgotten you just like I should. What a guy, what a fool am I to think my breaking heart could kid the moon. What's in store? Should I fall once more? No, it's best that I stick to my tune. I get along without you very well. Of course I do. Except perhaps in spring. But I should never think of spring, for that would surely break my heart into.
Chet Baker. Khalil, welcome back to the mics at WBAI.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be here with the WBAI listeners.
You got to fill us in. Everybody was, not everyone, many of our BAI listeners. Do I have the right mic on? I don't know. Can you be here? Wait, can you hear yourself?
Yes, I think so.
I'm not the master technician, as you know. The many followed your plight that, and I had said earlier that the week that you were to receive your master's degree at Lehman College, immigration came to your house, cuffed you in front of your wife and your little girls. And you were locked up for about 5 months, and didn't know whether you were going to be deported or not.
Yep, and didn't know what the ultimate outcome would be. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, it's just another example of how the system totally disregards any form of quote-unquote rehabilitation that a person achieves. You know, totally disregards any community ties that a person has, totally disregards any family ties. And more importantly, it's hell-bent on this idea of continuous punishment, right? This idea of perpetual punishment where, despite the fact that I had been sentenced to a prison term and successfully served that prison term, been sentenced to a term of community supervision, successfully completed that, and had taken advantage of some tremendous opportunities such as education and employment and family support, and had built a life for myself that many would have classified as quote-unquote successful, still in all, more than 4 years after my release, being in the community stable, being an asset to my community, DHS, Department of Homeland Security, specifically the Immigration and Customs Enforcement arm of that federal agency, came to my house and basically said that despite all of that, you're a name on our list that we have to check off, and you know, we have to arrest you, and ultimately ended up detaining me for 5 months.
That must have been a horrendous 5 months. I mean, you had done prison time, but this was, you had the wife and the kids, and you knew you would change your life so dramatically, and you had a taste of something rich and good. And is the immigration holding pattern very much like the prisons that we know?
Yeah, it mirrors it. I mean, it's, and in many ways, the psychological effect is more damaging. I mean, in my entire 6.5 years of serving a prison sentence in New York State, there were certain things that I knew. For instance, I knew that that there would be a date that I would be released. And I knew that, you know, I knew the outcome would be ultimately that one day I would leave prison. And, you know, and undoubtedly that's a benefit that many people don't have the luxury of saying, but I knew in my particular case that I did have that luxury. And when you're in immigration detention, you don't know that. You don't know when the process is going to end. It's indefinitely. It's not classified as a criminal process, as a criminal procedure. So there are certain things that mirror the criminal justice system, but there are certain things that are completely independent of that. So, you know, it's classified as a civil procedure. So, you know, you don't know a lot. I mean, and it's a process that you're trying to learn as you're playing the game. And that's ultimately the most dangerous way to learn anything is while you're playing it.
While you were there, did you see a lot of people just suddenly grabbed and sent overseas and they didn't know where or when or they didn't know who they were going to? Your country was?
Guyana.
And did you know no one there because you came here when you were two?
Exactly. Yeah, my mother and I migrated here in 1986. And I was actually 4 years old at the time. And over the course of the years, just completely having all of my family relocate to the United States of America, I had nobody in Guyana.
So what would you have done if you were sent to Guyana? Move to Canada or something? Could you have gone to Canada then and your family join you? Or would your wife and children have come down to Guyana?
I mean, ideally, I think that for me, getting as close to my family as possible would have been the goal, whether that was Canada or any other neighboring country for the United States. But then the other thing is that once you are someone who is deported and you have a stigma that comes with that.
And what do you do? How do you make a living?
Exactly. I mean, and more importantly, you know, how do you adjust to a culture that you totally consider to be foreign to you? I mean, in many ways, if I was to be deported to Guyana, because I had spent so much time in the U.S., you know, there's a lot of cultural differences that I'm totally oblivious to because of the fact that I've lived away from that country for over 3 decades.
All right, let's get to the good part. Are you now totally protected?
So as
do you have your citizenship?
No, not as yet. So as the listeners know, well, first let me just make the distinction that my mother and I did come here as green card holders, and so I always had the opportunity to be a naturalized citizen. But by the time my mother had naturalized with her citizenship, I had already been over the age of 18, and when I was released from prison, I obviously couldn't begin a naturalization process because I had had a felony conviction, and I knew that that was something that would ultimately lead me to being denied. But now, as I stand as one of the five people who've received pardons from Governor Cuomo, the collateral consequences of a criminal conviction, in my case, a felony conviction, has been eliminated. So one of those consequences is immigration consequences. So it opens up the door for me to apply for naturalization, which I plan to do hopefully within the next year.
And the pardon came ultimately because so many people spoke up in your defense. And I'll never forget the day that you came to the Fortune Society right after you got out. Joanne Page said, we advocate for many, but it was so easy for you to advocate for you because you did the work. When you were out here, people knew you because they saw you as a community asset, as a leader. BAI listeners knew you from On the Count. We knew you for your work with people who were coming out of prison. And Joanne was right. You did the work, and you were your own best advocate. Not to say that your wife wasn't incredible. I mean, she was tenacious, and she inspired us. But we knew you, mm-hmm. so it wasn't that difficult to say, mm-hmm. what are they doing to this man? Yeah. So now what are you doing? So you're free and clear.
Yeah, so free and clear, and sitting here with you and talking to you and your listeners. And so now I'm working at the Legal Action Center, which is a nonprofit organization that does litigation and policy around discrimination for people with criminal histories or people that are HIV positive or people who have histories of substance use. And I'm the policy associate there doing criminal justice reform on a city level, but also to some extent on a state level. So someone who's directly impacted doing the work in the field on a policy level, something that I'd aspired to do right after I had completed my MSW. And as you have mentioned, I was 1 week away when immigration came and grabbed me.
And you're doing some consulting with Fortune, are you not?
So, yes. Yeah, so I also, I still have Kinetic Solutions, which is a social media management consultancy, a small consultancy firm that helps people identify their voice on social media and how to use it. And, you know, most of our clients are non-for-profit organizations.
And your girls?
Yeah.
Smile on the face when I say his girls or his daughters, how they are five and?
8 and 4. So Mia's 8 and Mia's the oldest. And she's been on the air with On the Count. So maybe some of the listeners have heard her. And Ayana's 4. And
what was that like for them when you were away? Did your wife bring them to see you?
Yeah, my wife brought them to see me twice. And, you know, within the context of, again, not knowing, you know, I think having a visit when a person is being caged is particularly strenuous emotionally, psychologically, but it's exacerbated for a young child who doesn't understand the context. Who, you know, my daughters have always looked at me as daddy, as someone who brings stability, someone who, you know, holds a really good example in their eyes. And to then be placed in a place where, from their context, is for quote-unquote people who do bad things. And, you know, to try to still explain to them that this was because of a decision that I made a long time ago, way before I ever thought about having them, and way before I even dreamed of being a father, it was very difficult for them. And my youngest daughter, you know, used to say all the time to her mother, like, why isn't he coming home? Like, she just did not understand the concept.
Did you want them, was a part of you, didn't want them to visit?
Yeah, I mean, after the second visit, my wife and I just agreed that no matter what happened, that she wouldn't bring them back because it was just too much emotionally for them. I mean, for days after, like, they would cry. They would wake up and looking for me and sobbing. And my oldest daughter, you know, Mia, who is very strong person, emotionally, had the double burden of not only trying to be a older sister and set a good example for her younger sister in terms of how she handled it, but also having this deep connection with her father that she knew was going to be different. You know, like, she knew that no matter what happened moving forward, at least the way we saw it, whether I was deported and I stayed in Guyana or if I was deported and I ended up moving to another country, that it would always be this disconnect. And she had banked on our relationship being one that was frequent. Right? My daughters are used to waking up to having me in the household. And if I'm not in the household, they know that they can call me on the phone and we can do a video call, or, you know, that they can text me. So, you know, for them to not have that all of a sudden, literally overnight, it was a struggle for them. I mean, and even now, right before I came on and I was talking to Sean, you know, I had told him before that they had, you know, that they were very clinging to me when I first was released from immigration detention. And he asked me, you know, how is that going? And I told him, like, it has gone down somewhat, but it will probably always be there because
abandonment's, you know, a real issue for kids.
Exactly. And especially when they feel that it was, especially if they associate some type of blame in that.
Yeah, was there any hint at what did I do wrong to daddy that he's not here?
Yeah, so when I was probably about 3 or 4 days in immigration detention and still trying to understand the process and not fully, you know, accepting the fact that I was facing long-term detention, my wife had told my oldest daughter the morning that she woke up that your father had to go away on a business trip. Mm-hmm. And it was last minute, and he apologized, and she knew something was different because the first thing she said was, well, maybe if I was good, maybe if I was a little more gooder, she said, maybe he wouldn't have had to go on that trip. And, you know, this is a child who...
You walked her to school. You used to tell me about that. One of the great joys was...
Every day I would walk her to school. And, you know, I'm an engaged parent. Like, you know, for me, fatherhood is something that... And I tell people around me all the time, no matter everything that I do, my most important role is a father. And that's what grounds me, that's what anchors me, and that's how I view
it. Where does that come from? From your mother?
I think it comes from the fact that I hadn't had my father fully engaged in my life when I was growing up. You know, my father is a loving person, and, you know, he loves me, he cares for me, but he wasn't a full-time father.
But we hear so much about people emulating the sins of the father passed on to the sins of the child, mm-hmm. and you broke the cycle, so somebody must have imposed on you, mm-hmm. values or emotions.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that my mother undoubtedly instilled in me the hardcore values that I hold close to the chest. But I didn't identify those values until I was incarcerated. I didn't have that perspective. I didn't have that analysis. And I didn't have that maturity, honestly, to fully encapsulate that. And then to, more importantly, to apply that into my life. So it was in prison that I saw many things, and one of the things I saw was this pattern of fatherlessness.
Yeah.
And it disgusted me, and it enraged me, honestly. And in many ways I made a commitment to myself that when I was to become a father, that I would be one that was not, you know, one that was someone who would be engaged in every facet of my child's life. So walking my oldest daughter to school was something that I prided myself on. And it was something that, you know, that it was a bonding moment. You know, that 5 to 10 minute walk was a bonding moment every day for us. And for her to all of a sudden wake up one day and to be told that your father, who anytime he travels tells you weeks in advance to prepare her, overnight has to, and, you know, and then has to go on a business trip. And then, of course, seeing her mother emotional and flustered and, you know, not knowing what was going to happen. I mean, that morning.
So when you decide to come here early in the morning,
yeah.
do they say, is there
they're sleeping.
No, but, or when you go to work and they're up, yeah. do they say, are you coming back?
My youngest daughter says that pretty frequently.
Really?
You know, that when she goes to daycare and, you know, she always asks either my wife or myself, who's going to come pick us up? And, you know, we will ask her if we can, you know, who do you want to come pick you up? You want mommy to pick you up, daddy to pick you up? And there are many times when she says that she wants me to pick her up because she feels that, I know that that's associated with the fact that if I don't come, that there is a level of anxiety and there's a level of fear that comes with the fact that you might leave again, right? And I also understand that some of that, like, she blames me. You know, she still at 4 years old doesn't understand the context. She in many ways believes that it was my choice that I left, and then it was my choice that I came back. Mm. and therefore it will be my choice again that I leave. So sometimes she asks me,
how do you,
are you going to come back?
Are there therapists that deal with that? Do you talk? Is there people that you go to, got family guidance, people that?
So my wife and I, we seek spiritual guidance for that. You know, my wife and I try to work together as much as possible as a team to address some of those underlying fears. And I know that one of the main things that's going to help to heal that is time and consistency. Yeah. And, you know, I for me, again, you know, I don't have any plans on leaving my children again. So, you know, I'm hoping that
time
over the course of...
Boy, you should take those two words, bring them to Fortune and hang them out there. Yeah. Time and consistency. Yeah. The number of young people we have, who the fathers are in prison, their fathers, they're 19 and their fathers, and they don't have a clue. Yeah. Before we go on to the next topic, how are you responding to the Republican primary where the immigration has become the main issue? They're going towards a small percentage, the Republican primary voters, but the media focus so heavy on that.
Yeah.
It must be painful for you to hear this dialogue.
Yeah, I think the idea that you can other people so easily, and to totally devalue a person's humanity, and then to totally take it out of context, right? I mean, most of the people that I met in immigration detention that were undocumented, which for the most part is what most of the Republican candidates are talking about, most of them have told me that if I could find employment that would support myself and my family in my country, I would do that. That coming here to the United States of America, understanding the consequences, the dire consequences, and most of the times that means either being exploited or being murdered or being... or something worse, that this is the lesser of two evils for them. And then understanding that, it's our...
The people you met, did you have people that you met while you were being held that told you that going back might end their lives?
Yeah, no, there were people in immigration detention that had documents that... people in their government, whether it was local police or local militia, or if it was the government itself, were very categorically killing some of their family members. And I remember meeting one guy who had 6 death certificates, and one of them was of his mother, of his family members being murdered.
Do you ever see Failure? That's what happened with his mother was killed.
No, I never saw that. So there are people who, so there are people who say, I would much rather stay in my country and work and, support my family. But because of the foreign policies, particularly around economics that the United States have implemented, has decimated our local market. So that's one type of people. Then you have the type of people who say, I have to literally come here to seek asylum. And even though I came here undocumented and was deported, I have to come back again because... the reason why I came here the first time was yet to be addressed.
They are political exiles. Then.
Yeah, people who need to seek asylum, but because they came here undocumented, it kind of gives it a different context for them to begin their fighting.
We're talking with Khalil Cumberbatch. I'm so depressed now. I don't know. I'm going to take a musical break, and we'll be back in a minute. Here's Etta James. That should pick you up.
Again, this couldn't happen again. This is that once in a lifetime. This is the thrill divine. I have such as you would suddenly, suddenly be mine. Mine to hold as I'm holding you now. Oh, and never, never, never so near.
Ed of James, before we talk again with Khalil Cumberbatch, I want to remind you that we have tickets. The Flick, most of the tickets are gone, but there's a couple of left, two or three left, for the Pulitzer Prize-winning play at the Barrow Street Theater, Annie Baker's play that I saw last week. It's long. It's intense. If you're a theater goer, I think that you'll like it. It's not for the tourists, certainly. It's not Aladdin. It's a play about three lost people working in a movie theater in Western Massachusetts, one of the old theaters before the multiplex. It's called The Flick. And these are simple, complicated, if that makes sense, people who are just trying to get by. And yet it stays with you long after you've left the theater, which I, you know, when I said, why did this win the Pulitzer Prize? The more I think of it, I understand why. It's The Flick. For $65 to BAI, you get a pair of tickets. Best offer you'll have in town. We had originally we said we had tickets for Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Sunday matinee, and Sunday night of Labor Day weekend. And I know a lot of folks are around Labor Day weekend. They say they're going away, but I walked to Times Square and I said, now look at all the people that didn't get invited somewhere. But some of us choose to stay in the city. It's a great place to be over the holidays. So if you want to see The Flick, you can call us at 347-942-2037. Now, these are two men who have cell phones. So if you, it's not like a switchboard when you call Channel 13. And if one line's busy, the next 12 ring. This is BAI, where we do it with spit and a rubber band. If you came to the studio, you'd think I'd be overstating the case. 347-942-2037, and the other number is 917-600-3469. And Easy, who's at 917-600-3469, was eating the largest sandwich I ever saw. So if you call and you hear some mumbling, you've gotten Easy. To see The Flick. Also, we have some tickets, a lot of tickets from Africa, My Beautiful, which I recommend highly. We have tickets this week and next, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at the Playroom Theater. $50 for a pair of tickets if you want to hear two beautiful women sing glorious songs and tell stories of their African heritage. It's about growing up. It's about when they were young girls. One grew up under apartheid, the other post-apartheid, and how their lives differ and what influenced them. And they do it through the most beautiful singing and dance, I may add. Africa, My Beautiful, at the Playroom, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday night, this week and next. And you can call those same numbers, 347-942-2037 or 917-600-3469. If you get a busy signal, you'll call back in a couple of minutes. They'll still be there, and Easy may have finished his sandwich by then. Khalil, we wanted to talk about, the original premise was to talk about that beating of the guard in I guess you call it the goon squad. They have different names in different prisons. But you and I recently shared an experience. We were in court about a case that really perplexes me, where a man was sentenced to prison for viewing pornography in his home. And I don't, and I have, it always, you know, when I present my argument, people say, "What am I defending pornography?" I make no value judgment on pornography about the people that watch it. I don't know why the viewing of it, even, and as I said to you, you didn't know about that, there are snuff movies, actual movies made of somebody being killed. Although we watch it on the news every night, we all see it. We're all witness to, and certainly with the Times Square nudity, we're the Daily News out so outraged by it that they printed about 100 pictures of nearly nude women on the on their papers, in case you didn't get to Times Square. So why are we we see prison as the answer to anything that bothers us, it seems. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think first it's important to state that this was a person who had the liberty of having the freedom for more than 2 years since the beginning of their case, and had engaged in not only community service and, you know, was volunteering at a, you know, at a major organization, but also had been seeking active therapy and had had two psychosocials done that basically said that with therapy, underline, underscore, bold, italic, with therapy, the likelihood of this person committing any future offense was almost non-existent with therapy.
Well, in my view, though, he hadn't committed an offense. I know by law he had.
Yeah, sure. I'm just stating, like, basically what was said in court. That
the makers of the pornography might be, I don't know if they've ever confronted, mm-hmm. but I don't see going into someone's home. I don't get it.
Yeah. No, so I think with all of those factors, you know, because then someone would say, yeah, well, if a person is going to view certain forms of pornography, then they should be in prison. But the context is that, you know, punishment is not the knee-jerk default reaction. Well, it is, but it shouldn't be the default reaction. The idea that we can punish our way, you know, that we can, you know, that we can punish people and that would set them right is inherently flawed, and that's gotten us to the point where we now have 2.3 million people incarcerated, and you know, and your listeners know the statistics better than me probably, but in the end, this is a case where when you're looking to enact punishment, the criminal justice system on a federal, state, local level, its main context and main lens of analyzing that punishment is how much time do we have to put you in prison, not what are some of the other opportunities available to us, and in this case therapy and engaged community service, what are some of the other ways that we can still at the same time hold you accountable but not give you a punishment that will, you know, that will, that doesn't necessarily help the person.
How many millions of people in America do you think view pornography, and who decides that which is the pornography that's acceptable and the which isn't?
I have no clue how many people view pornography.
I mean, there's a distinction made mm-hmm. between child pornography and adult pornography, mm-hmm. consenting adults, and you wonder what are the there's an op-ed piece in the Times today by a woman who was in the sex trade, and mm-hmm. she says that it's considered consenting adults, but all sorts of pressure, she mm-hmm. says, drove her into that, mm-hmm. into sex trade, no options, desperate situation. I don't know how people decide what morally offends them means that someone else has to be imprisoned as a result of it. It's almost
What I would like to see is, particularly like in cases that you and I sat through yesterday, is this idea that we can send somebody to prison and the prison system is designed to give them everything that they need to be better.
Yes, and a man like and a man who had been watching pornography could go to prison and be raped, mm-hmm. and as part of the system, mm-hmm. because that's part and parcel of what happens in prison, with no moral overview of that as part of it. It's a given.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, and more importantly, he would be severed from the same exact supports that he's had that has kept him stable. Since the offense, or since he was arrested.
And I was told by someone that if he was in another courtroom in another county, he would have gotten probation. So it's a crapshoot, mm-hmm. there.
Which is, again, another huge problem of the criminal justice system, that we would be taught to believe that there's this sense of uniformity. And in many ways, the only uniformity that exists is mandatory minimums and so on and so forth. Yeah. But, you know, the idea that you know, someone could be given a punishment for the same exact crime or given two different punishments for the same exact offense is, you know, is unfathomable. I mean, you know, you want to view prison as a place where if someone's actions deems them to be sentenced to a prison term, that they would also be given all of the supports that they need while they're incarcerated.
Well, we get down to fundamentals about a skewed society which makes moral judgments and goes to war with impunity and drops bombs, and that violence is acceptable but sex is not. And at some point we have to deal with the reality. I don't know if it's the pornography or the reality of sexual behavior that offends us, and then it gets so confusing, mm-hmm. and psychological, and interreligious roots that frighten and terrify people. Let's talk about the. I don't want to dismiss this topic, but there's so many things to cover. The story that prompted us talking again was the revelation that in Fishkill, and you and I had heard about this long before the Times had exposed the story, that an inmate who was a troubled inmate. Apparently, he packed his grip one day and said, I'm going home, indicative of a man who had some serious emotional mental issues, which is prevalent in the prisons, and beaten up and killed by now accused. And, of course, everybody that you and I know that have done time said, so what's new?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the most striking part of this quote-unquote expose by the New York Times is this idea that this is something new, that this is a new phenomenon. And the reality is that from my personal experience, but also just historically within the prison system, is that physical punishment enacted by the same people who are entrusted to keep people safe in prison is something that is commonplace. And it's a form of social control that is sanctioned. It is okayed. It is sometimes prompted by local administrators, the system itself.
It's not videotaped like what we're seeing on the streets these days.
And yeah, I mean, while you do have some interactions that are videotaped, certain cell extractions have to be videotaped in certain states. But in the end, no, instances like what happened to this individual,
Samuel Harrell.
Yeah, is commonplace in New York State. I mean, I remember when I was in Greenhaven Correctional Facility that they also had a beat-up squad. And I remember when
they were known as the what were they called?
That's what they were called, the beat up squad. So when I see that term in the New York Times, you know, that's a term that basically is equivalent to the Gestapo, and it's equivalent to this idea that you can randomly be chosen to become a victim just because this is a form of social control, that this is a way to keep people, quote-unquote, in line.
There was another murder recently of an inmate by guards, and the story in the Middletown paper said three guards wounded, inmate killed, mm-hmm. and they talked about the injuries. And when I talked to men who had been incarcerated, almost without prompting, they, and individually, not in the same company, they all said, Well, the guard was probably injured by the inmate fighting back. Mm-hmm. That when you read that the guard was wounded, that it's often the inmate being beaten might kick or bite or punch back after while he's being beaten. But the article conveys the impression that the inmate attacked and created that, and as a result was beaten. And that the beatings come about because, well, Eric Garner, we saw that. He was selling Lucy's, mm-hmm. which is hardly an offense that mm-hmm. warrants the death penalty.
Yeah, many mainstream media is guilty of being complicit in the way that people are perceived who are incarcerated.
Well, not investigating. You're too young. Attica.
Yeah, no, that's the first thing I thought of.
The guards had their throats slashed by inmates. Yeah. Medical examiner 2 days later, after the front page headlines around the world, inmates slashed throats of guard hostages. Mm-hmm. Medical examiner says they were shot by state mm-hmm. bullets. Coroner, Wyoming County coroner, fired from the job. Mm-hmm.
For identifying the truth. So yeah, I mean, I think even if correctional officers are injured in a dispute or breaking up a fight, or in this case murdering somebody, in my personal experience, that's because of injuries that come from a physical altercation. I mean, when you're engaged in a physical altercation, it's highly likely that you're going to sprain an ankle or hurt your wrist or get a bruise or get a laceration. And in many cases, that comes from the other correctional officers who are engaged in a very animalistic behavior. And when you're engaged in that behavior, you don't identify someone as being a foe or a friend. I mean, you're basically swinging, and in many cases, these officers use their sticks, and they aim for anything that is moving. And unfortunately, in Mr. Harrell's case, you know, not only was he savagely beaten to the point where he died, but he was then also thrown down the stairs, and which also then brings a different level of heinousness to the crime, because then it shows that there's this idea that even after you subdue somebody, that is not enough.
And this is where the system breaks down. Inmates who witnessed it, who mentioned to relatives, which began the probing at the Times, that they witnessed, the inmates that witnessed it, not the guards that did the beating, were thrown in solitary confinement.
Yeah,
and were beaten themselves.
It's the same thing that happened in Clinton when the two men escaped.
Yes, and the governor came in and was implying, why didn't you guys know? And it was staff mm-hmm. that was complicit.
Yeah, this idea that people who are incarcerated are at the crux of all of the issues that revolve around breaches of security is one, again, that mainstream media is, in many cases, most mainstream media is complicit in, because we all know for a fact, and there are some media that reported that majority of major contraband comes into the facilities via either correctional staff or other civilian
employees.
Tell that
to Commissioner Ponte in New York.
I mean,
do you love the? By the way, you know the news called for the Commissioner Ponte, New York City Department of Correction, to be fired, and they did a series of reports on the brutalities and the breakdown at Rikers Island, and the Daily News was banned from inmates on Rikers Island last week. I called the reporter and said, I think they're relying on the fact, and the press may not know it, but in 1970, I think it was, the Fortune Society, a new organization, had a newsletter that the Attica would not let in. Mm-hmm. And Fortune Society versus McGinnis, mm-hmm. the federal courts ruled
that
when you lock somebody up, you do not have the right to block their literature and their reading matter. And they're defiant of federal law, assuming that no one knows it. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the right to keep the Daily News out. Mm-hmm. Daily News didn't even know that they didn't have the right to keep them out. Mm-hmm. And you know, while the papers are doing all this report on it, I get a call from someone who was on Rikers saying, it hasn't trickled down here. Nothing has changed. Mm-hmm. The Daily News exposures, the publishers, oh, there's all this activity going on. He said the behavior of the guards, the fights, everything, it's the same.
Yeah, because that, you know, that level of scrutiny is still focused on the system as a whole, and it's not focused on it hasn't been able to permeate that overall, like that big structure. And, you know, focusing on people like Commissioner Aponte is useless. I mean, what we really need to do is break the culture of jails and prisons, where we understand that people are sent to prison and still punished further. And this is a prime example of Mr. Harrell, someone who has documented history of mental illness, clearly was displaying signs of some form of a mental, you know, breakdown.
And what they do is they put someone in solitary when they have a form of a mental breakdown. Well, the young man, Browder, who killed himself.
Khalif Browder, yeah.
Horrible. He attempted suicide on Rikers and then was put in solitary at the point where you need tense intervention in behalf of someone's psychological.
So again, makeup. In relation to the case that we were talking about earlier, is this knee-jerk reaction that more punishment is inevitably the answer? That, you know, that a person packing their bags, telling a correctional officer that I'm leaving because my family is coming to pick me up, the idea that they can say that and be punished or put into solitary or locked into their cell as the answer is ridiculous.
You know, when the Fortune Society began, and I was just becoming acquainted through stories of people like yourself about what's happening in prison, I made a very simple statement, and it's as accurate today. Our need to punish is greater than our needs to solve our problems. There's that need to punish, which has nothing to do with solving the problem. There's some psychological macho thing that if we punish, then we are exerting power and control over people who we've disapproved of. And it doesn't lessen crime, and it doesn't change behavior. In fact, it exacerbates mm-hmm. antisocial behavior. Well, you've lived it. You've seen it. Mm-hmm. You know it.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And when you add other circumstances like race,
well, that's control and power, too.
Exactly. So, you know, that only more – it only makes the water more dirty, so to speak.
What do we do? We create, I guess, a constituent. That's the fight, is to create a constituency for problem solving rather than there is a constituency for punishment, mm-hmm. to increase the constituency for problem solving. Mm-hmm. For the court case we went to, him not being in prison, for the man that called me from Rikers Island on a $25,000 bail on a case for which he has maintained innocence, and which involves $40, should not even be there, mm-hmm. should be on the street. What we're doing on WBAI mm-hmm. The Daily News is doing it for 3 days. What the system knows mm-hmm. is that by next week, the Daily News will be on another issue, and it'll exactly. fade into the woodwork in Seabrook and the Corrections Officers Union, which defends the use of solitary. Mm-hmm. That's their way of control and power. What they do upstate, mm-hmm. It will continue.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the main thing that we as people who are concerned about this issue need to do is to have tough conversations outside of ourselves. I mean, it's really great to talk to WBAI listeners, the majority of whom are technically, or I would largely assume, are the choir or very close to being the converted. But these type of conversations, because there are people who believe that someone who is displaying a mental health issue should be placed in solitary because that may be the most secure place for you. But they don't understand the context. They don't understand that, you know, that damages a person even more psychologically. And at that point, when they're very fragile, that they need different type of response, that those are the people that we need to be reaching. The other thing is that we need to be unapologetically holding people accountable. Correctional officers, regardless of whatever uniform they wear, whatever oath that they've taken, if they beat someone savagely, and if a medical coroner identifies that this person's wounds is in line with homicide, that those people should be brought up on charges. The fact that they are civil servants should be something that's taken into consideration, but it also should be the major fact is that they have been charged with enacting brutal punishment on someone that they did not have the jurisdiction to do that.
Certainly the Times article needs follow-up. You know, I for the last several weeks, I've been announcing on the air that people are invited to Fortune Society on Thursday, and I give them a tour. I'm going to change that to Mondays, starting in September, not Labor Day, but we're going to do it on Mondays. Every Monday at 11, you're invited. And many, many have come. And what I get the biggest kick out of, we go to the classrooms and the job, right? But we go at 12 o'clock, they feed about 150 people at Fortune, a hot meal in the second mm-hmm. room. You've been there and you've mm-hmm. seen it. And I said, you know, if you've ever gone into, they don't have it anymore, but they used to have cafeterias and dining rooms or whatever you call it in Rikers, and they have it in all prisons. They're always the tensest places I've been because it's where trouble happens for whatever reasons, the mix of people there. And when you watch, this is the same population that's having lunch at Fortune, and the atmosphere, I said, it's like a college student union, mm-hmm. because an atmosphere has been created that's supportive and challenging in the best sense of the word, that people can change. Mm-hmm. And it does happen, and we see it happen, mm-hmm. but it doesn't happen in those institutions, and society picks up the tab for its failures. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that in most facilities on any day that there is, you know, that there's nonviolence, that people go about their day, they go to programs, they go to their jobs, you know, they go to the recreational area. But there are times when people, because of sheer frustration, because of lack of programming, because of the lack of care just from certain administrations locally, that these people are frustrated. And I would say that people at Fortune Society, for the most part, you know, when you're standing on that line waiting for that meal, one, you know, you're waiting for a meal that most people are going to, you know, that's a, probably the heart, like the biggest meal of their day. So, you know, that they definitely want to get that meal before it runs out. But also that they've been empowered because of the programming, because of the atmosphere that that Fortune Society, you know, establishes. And when you're in prison and jail, that atmosphere is not fostered the same.
The nutritionist who prepares the meals at Fortune said she's very aware of the fact that they have to have meals that are nutritious and there has to be cultural identity in it. She said, but the most important thing is that so many of the people, mealtime was a trauma time for them growing up or in institutions or in youth houses. And that the most important thing is to have an ambiance that is, you see, while they're reading this, we sometimes have people playing music. There's chess games going on. There's a pool table. They have staff people sit and interact with them, unlike guards. Mm-hmm. It's all part of it. I want to by the way, I mentioned that we're going to switch it on to Mondays. If you want to come, email me, dprfortune@hotmail.com. DPR, those are my initials, displaced person, Rothenberg. dprfortune@hotmail.com. Leave your phone number, and I'll call you back. Starting the it'll be the 7th of September. We'll be doing it at Mondays at 11. We're going to take a musical break before we say goodbye to Khalil, because guess what? It's almost time. Here's, and then we'll do a final, find out what's left in the theater tickets from Sunday in the Park with George.
Tension. Thank you.
blank page or canvas?
Well, we love Sunday in the Park with George, but this is going on and on and on, and we have to say goodbye. Before I say goodbye to you, Khalil, there's one pair of tickets left for The Flick, the Pulitzer Prize-winning play by Annie Baker, which is at the Barrow Street Theater. It's Wednesday night at 7:30, $65 gift to BAI. First one that calls, it gets it, 347-942-2037 is the number. You can call for that one remaining pair of tickets for The Flick at the Barrow Street Theater. This is for real theatergoers. It's not for tourists. It's not for men coming in from Dubuque. It's for people who want to go to the theater and come out talking about the substance of a play. Africa, My Beautiful, we still have tickets for Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday this week and next. Beautiful musical, which reflects apartheid. And you want to take your wife. Be my guest and go see Africa, My Beautiful. I'll tell you about where you can, someplace else where you can see it this Wednesday. I loved Africa, My Beautiful, and I recommend it highly. We have tickets for it Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. It's at the Playroom Theater. It's $50 a pair of tickets. Two gorgeous singing voices, dancing, and stories of Africa. Africa, My Beautiful. And the numbers to call for that are 347-942-2037 or 917-600-3469. And Khalil, the time went by. Who would know?
So fast.
So fast. So what do we do? What's the answer?
We're
doing
I guess. Yeah.
Just talking about it.
Yeah.
We're doing it. We're making, creating some awareness.
Yeah, no, one awareness is one part of the problem, but then we need to motivate people to know that they can do something. I think that too many times people identify the problem and then say, well, you know, what do we do? And the problem is just too big. But
well, it isn't. I say, you know, while you're waiting to change the world, work with one person. And one of the things I found that volunteers who come to the Fortune Society as tutors or just being in the ambience and meeting people, they learn so much about what could be done that suddenly they're advocates in their community. Mm-hmm. They're calling their council person or their state, their federal congressperson. Mm-hmm. They do that.
Yeah, no, I subscribe to that. I mean, I subscribe to the mentality that, you know, you have to work with people, then you have to also work with systems in many cases simultaneously. But there are many people who are in the middle of the left and the right, or on our side or the other side, and they say, well, this problem is too big. I may as well just, you know, go about living my daily life and not be too concerned. And if someone can't face the punishment, then they shouldn't commit the crime. But the reality is that we need to,
they're coming home.
So we have to also educate people, and then we have to motivate them. So if anyone wants to kind of learn more about the work that I do at Legal Action Center, they can visit the website at lac.org. So it's LAC, very simple website address, lac.org. If anybody wants to learn more about my work, it's Khalil, K-H-A-L-I-L, Cumberbatch, Khalil Cumberbatch.
C-U-M-B-E-R.
C-U-M-B-E-R-B-A-T-C-H. Yep, KhalilCumberbatch.com.
And if you want to come and do the tour with me at the Fortune Society starting on Mondays, the second Monday in September, and every Monday, you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Doesn't that sound obscene? Hotmail.com. That's my pornography, is my email address. Khalil, thank you for joining us. We have to do
Thank you for having me.
We'll do this more frequently. Now we're going to say goodbye. Carly Simon says goodbye. What's next? City Watch here? City Watch in the house? City Watch is here.
In the know, think they allow you to go. And when you're near, there's such an air of spring about it. I can hear a lark somewhere begin to sing about it.
This is Barbara Glickstein. Diana Mason and I co-host Health Styles. Here's my ask. Please become a BAI buddy. It's only 33 cents a day, and that math equals $10 a month, and you're going to be supporting your station. Why don't you become one of us? Become that activist global citizen making a difference in the world every day, and just for 33 cents. We've been around for quite a while here at WBAI, and we think this is an awesome new idea. So please join us and become a BAI buddy. Go to WBAI.org and sign up. And thank you.
Hey, I'm Basir Mjawi. I've been a producer and host of Education at the Crossroads on WBAI for the last 19 years. On September 17th,
7 o'clock,
we're going to be doing something special on Education at the Crossroads. We're going to be doing some Sloan-esque audio drama, and it's going to be quite interesting. I support uprising of the downtrodden.
Doesn't come.
Were you waiting for me, Dan Malley?
Who's that? Who spoke?
The Shadow.
The Shadow?
There isn't much time, Malley. They're coming after you to take you to the chair. Speak quickly. What have you to say?
Just this. For the best in old-time radio thrills, adventure, and comedy, tune in to the Golden Age of Radio, 7 to 9, Sunday nights, right here on WBAI New York.
My name's Chris Hedges. I'm the author with the cartoonist Joe Sacco of Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And when Joe and I are in New York, we always listen to WBAI 99.5 or WBAI.org because we want to stay informed and not get fed the commercial lies of the corporate media.